Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show that allows time to explore some in-depth conversations, topics that really empower you so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And I'm so glad you're joining me once again for another fantastic show. I really have been highlighting this month the myths and truths around cardiovascular disease because this is February. It is Heart Month. And I have been presenting for the entire month of February my Wholehearted Heart Month series, as I like to call it, where I've invited some wonderful practitioners, researchers, authors to really reveal to you the truth about what's going on in regards to cardiovascular disease. There's so much to be said on this topic. We're just getting going. In fact, over the next several shows, I'm going to be continuing because I think there's just a lot that we need to know and understand. So as we continue with this Wholehearted Heart Month series, today we are going to have a fantastic show. I have invited Dr. David Zava to be with us today. We're going to be talking about what you need to know to assess your heart health risks. And it's not, you know, it's not what you think. It's not what your doctors have told you. There's a bigger story. And if you really want to be able to be proactive and look at what's going on within your body, Dr. Zava is the person who's going to help us understand how best to do that. So let me first just tell you a little bit about Dr. David Zava. He has devoted his 40-year professional career to exploring the role of hormones in aging and disease. After completing his PhD in biochemistry at the University of Tennessee, Dr. Zava spent much of his time doing basic research on hormones and breast cancer in Texas, Switzerland, California, and Oregon. In 1998, he established ZRT Laboratory, a CLIA-certified laboratory that is a front runner in the innovative development of test methods to identify hormonal imbalances that can lead to debilitating symptoms, diminished quality of life, and increased risk for cancers and many of the diseases of aging, such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and senile dementia. ZRT Laboratory was one of the first laboratories to develop and commercialize non-invasive saliva and dried urine types of testing and semi-invasive dried blood spot methods for testing hormones as an alternative to conventional serum testing. These home collection methods pioneered by ZRT have proven to be far more convenient for the patient and the healthcare provider and are proving to be extremely valuable for research studies, especially where conventional tests of serum or liquid urine are prohibitively expensive and logistically impossible. So using these unique methods of body fluid collection, ZRT is actively engaged in hormone research studies with universities, government, and military agencies, private physicians, and professional sports teams. In addition to his innovations in clinical laboratory testing and development and numerous scientific publications over the past 40 years, Dr. Zava co-authored a landmark book, What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Breast Cancer, How Hormone Balance Can Help Save Your Life. In his book, Dr. Zava and co-authors describe how breast cancer can be caused by hormonal imbalances that occur naturally as we age, but can be prevented if the types of hormonal balances are identified with testing and restored to optimal healthy levels with bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and improved lifestyle. So a lot Dr. Zava has accomplished in his life, more to come, no doubt. And first of all, let me welcome Dr. David Zava to the show. Hello, Dr. Zava.
Hello, Dr. Selman. How are you?
I'm good. It's great having you back on the show. You've been a guest before. It's always such a pleasure to have you because I learn so much from you. And this is no exception to the rule because we have so many important things to talk about today in regards to the whole issue of cardiovascular disease and the risk factors that increase or even cause that problem. So I'd just like you to just start off by sharing some of your insights. You've done, you've had so many years of testing and developing these innovative tests that give some really relevant data. So I guess I want to start by asking you, Dr. Zava, what do you think is the most relevant risk factors we need to look at when it comes to our cardiovascular health?
Oh, I think you know, people who are not exercising enough, stress is huge, you know, and just how you perceive stress and deal with stressors. It's usually people that get cardiovascular disease are dealing with excessive stressors. You know, we measure hormones and certainly and risk factors for cardiovascular disease like insulin, like HDL and cholesterol and triglycerides and C-reactive protein and all these different things that are associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And we definitely see that. And we're doing lots of studies with a number of different organizations. But the last time I counted, I think we have about 60 different ongoing research projects, some of which are related to cardiovascular risk factors and hormones or, you know, blood lipids and things like that. So that's really why we developed the methods that we developed and the tests that we developed, because they're a simple way of being able to collect the sample. And I spent many years in research and realized that, you know, one of the drawbacks to being able to do studies is just simply you couldn't collect a biological sample. So by using dried blood, dried urine or saliva, those are simple collections that can be done at home so that we could be able to measure things. But in my field of expertise, where we look at hormones, certainly it's very clear that low thyroid is associated with cardiovascular disease. Some of the elements that we're testing now, such as arsenic, are closely related to cardiovascular disease, and that might be linked into lower levels of other important elements such as selenium. You know, those are tests we're now doing in dried urine. Clearly, research coming out. I just read a paper yesterday that showed that higher arsenic levels, lower selenium, is associated with stroke in women in India, where they tend to be overexposed to arsenic. So, and then you go to the hormones. Certainly, as a woman moves into menopause and her estrogens drop, it's associated with increased risk of cardiovascular events. A really high cortisol, particularly if it's produced at night, is associated with more stress. It may not be causing the cardiovascular events, but it's an index of the stress involved in the person. I know it's very controversial right now, and that is testosterone and cardiovascular disease. Certainly, physiologic levels of testosterone are really important for a healthy heart and healthy other parts of the body. The literature that just recently been published, three papers over the last few years showing that that the supplemental testosterone in men increases their risk for cardiovascular events if they already have certain high risk, and that's still controversial, and nobody has quite figured out why that is so. And that's contrary to the literature that's out there, that testosterone is very important for many different things related to the heart. Thyroid, we do thyroid testing, and lots of literature on low thyroid and even subclinical hypothyroidism, where you have normal T3 and T4 levels but high TSH levels, and it being associated with increased cardiovascular risk. So lots and lots of things that we do are clearly linked to increased cardiovascular risk. And of course, you got to eat right and take care of yourself. But
You know, you covered lots of different areas that I find really fascinating. So maybe we should just cover each of them as we go along in our conversation. So I'd like to start with what's considered cardiometabolic risk. So there's a new term out there called cardiometabolic risk. You have a cardiometabolic profile out of your lab. So maybe you can explain that to my listeners. Why are we looking at and probably more appropriately looking at a cardiometabolic profile, just not your normal LDL, HDL, and that's it, assessment for your risk? And then we can move on, because the thyroid really fascinates me and its role in cardiovascular risk, so we can get there as well.
Yeah, the cardiometabolic is it's a test that we do primarily in a dried blood spot. So we're looking at the typical types of things that you know, you'd look at if you went to your doctor and they say, let's do a blood draw and just kind of see where you're at, and they'll tell you, okay, your cholesterol's high, or it's okay, or you know, and the knee-jerk response is they're going to put you on some lipid-lowering drug, which is probably not really the main problem. So we do that, cholesterol, HDL, LDL, cholesterol, triglycerides. We look at C-reactive protein, which is an index of inflammation, and cardiovascular disease is an inflammation in the body. So we can look at that. We look at insulin, because if you're insulin resistant, meaning your body, if you eat food and the carbohydrates go into your bloodstream, and they should be moving into tissues, and if the tissues are resistant, because they call it insulin resistance, then your pancreas will produce more insulin, and so insulin builds up. So you end up with a lot of carbohydrate in the bloodstream, but also a lot of insulin. The insulin is trying to push it in, and it can't do it. So you're insulin resistant, and that's the beginning of diabetes. That's like having one foot in the door of diabetes when your insulin goes up. Eventually, as you become diabetic, your pancreas says, "I've had it, not working anymore. I'm retiring," and it gives it up, and so you don't make any insulin, and your glucose levels really climb, and we see that. And the other test we do is hemoglobin A1C. That's a test for measuring. It's a glycated hemoglobin, and it's an index of your overall glucose levels over the last couple months. So if you're above about 7, then you're going to get a diagnosis of diabetes. And some people don't know. They're walking around with diabetes, and they don't realize they have it, and their hemoglobin A1C is really high. So those are most of the things that we're looking at in the cardiometabolic and profile, and we can add on to that the steroids and other things to look at, and also vitamin D is part of that, because that's, if your vitamin D levels are low, then that's your blood lipids are not going to quite be right. But it's, your estrogens have to be right, your androgens have to be right. If your cortisol is too high, if you're under a lot of stress, what happens, your brain perceives that, okay, I'm stressed, and so it puts out a lot of stress hormone, cortisol. What cortisol does is it shuts the doors to your cells that normally burn the glucose for energy, and so you become more insulin resistant. So your insulin levels climb up, and your blood sugar levels go up. So it's just redirecting. It's redirecting the way the carbohydrates are utilized. So they're stored, and you tend to store those carbohydrates more in your midsection. So we like to ask people, what's your weight? What's your body mass index? What is your waist size? Because the waist size is telling you something about your risk. Your risk for cardiovascular disease, because if your waist is large, it's the guys with the pot bellies. That's what we're talking about. A lot of fat. That glucose is stored as fat, And it's particularly problematic under stress situations. You know, often I'll hear women say, "Oh God, it's the Christmas holidays again. I can't stand it because I got in-laws coming in and I got to fix all these dinners and do all these different things and I'm stressed out and I just eat, you know, I go for the easy foods that give me a quick fix and which is basically sugar." And they'll say, "God, I gained all this weight and I gained it in my waist." Well, that's what's happening, is the weight gain is around the waist. That's the most problematic and is more closely associated with heart disease, is the weight around the waist.
So the reason why this term cardiometabolic risk factor and the profile you have is that the term is so important, because most people, when they look at their cardiovascular risk, they may just look at what we know as HDL and LDL, right? That's kind of in triglycerides. But what we really want to do is to understand that the risk for our cardiovascular events is really the result of inflammation. It's really a result of the fact that we are insulin resistant, we're having too many carbs, it's showing up in this blood work, and that really is the signal we should be listening to avert potential disaster down the track. We just can't look at LDL and HDL. It's a much bigger story, which is really what I hear you saying.
Right. Yeah, so it's all those markers. And then, you know, those are warning signs, so, hey, get back to the, you know, moving around more, eating a little bit less, eating better foods, and reducing your stress as much as you can. And you know, if your hormones are off, you're not going to feel as well, and you may not want to go out and do something, be proactive about changing your life. For example, in men and even women. You know, the testosterone drops, they just don't feel like it anymore. They don't feel like exercising. They don't have the energy. So it's a lot about mood and wanting to do the things you know you're supposed to do. If you're young, you know, you look at young people, they're just constantly moving. You know, they're exercising all the time, even when they're sitting still, they're moving. We don't move as much. We have jobs that keep us sitting most of the day, so it's getting out and moving and burning the carbohydrates and burning the food that we're consuming, and consume less food and consume better food, because if you get a lot of junk in your food, it's going to create what we call reactive oxygen species, and those are just going to create this inflamed condition in your body. Hmm. And we see that in C-reactive protein. So,
Can we just talk about C-reactive protein so people understand that, you know, because for the entire month of February, we've been talking about cardiovascular risk with cardiovascular surgeons and cardiologists and traditional Chinese medicine practitioners, all understanding basically the same thing, that cardiovascular disease is the result of chronic inflammation occurring throughout the body, but also showing up in our arteries. And that one of the markers for that level of inflammation that's used most commonly is CRP, or
C-reactive protein.
C-reactive protein, I'm sorry. I'm blank there. But maybe we can just spend just a couple of minutes helping people understand why this this marker, C-reactive protein, is so critical to be addressing as, you know, information we are gathering about what's going on within us and increasing our risk of heart disease.
Really, if you think about it, it's not just heart disease. It's cancer. It's diabetes. It's Alzheimer's. It's just about every disease is associated with inflammation in the body. So this is C-reactive protein is a marker of inflammation. It says, yeah, you've got inflammation. So you need to, it doesn't necessarily say what's causing it, but certainly it can be associated with cardiovascular disease. You know, people with gingivitis and problems of their teeth. That's an inflammation. That is also associated with cardiovascular disease. So it's staying healthy in every way possible. And reducing those things that cause inflammation. And that gets to, you know, are you getting enough of certain elements? And that's what we're testing. We're certainly looking at selenium, which is, and iodine both, which are very important, antioxidants in the human body, as is vitamin C and vitamin E and, lots of plant phytochemicals. These are natural antioxidants.
Well, let's go over to the thyroid, because I think the thyroid plays such a major role with so many functions in the body, and I want people to understand more of the relationship between the thyroid and a thyroid that is out of balance, that is hypothyroid, that is compromised, not responding appropriately, and how it affects increased risk of many things, including cardiovascular disease. So can you kind of give us a primer, Dr. Zava, to understand a little bit more about the thyroid and what a hypothyroid condition can, why it's a risk factor for us?
I can start with the real basics of thyroid. You know, thyroid's made in your thyroid gland. It requires iodine, requires the amino acid tyrosine. So that basically what your thyroid gland does is it has some mechanism called symporters that pull iodine out of your bloodstream and concentrate it, and then there's an enzyme called thyroid peroxidase that's very specific to the thyroid gland, and that activates the iodine. That's an iron-dependent enzyme, so here you have a need for iron. And then it activates the iodine, and then it sticks it on the tyrosine of this great big protein called thyroglobulin. And those are unique to the thyroid, and then it puts it into a pool, a lumen, and then as the body needs thyroid, the brain is sensing how much thyroid it has. So when the brain senses that there isn't enough thyroid in the bloodstream, it releases thyroid stimulating hormone. So that's coming from the area of the brain called the hypothalamic pituitary axis. So it's constantly sensing. So there's this relationship between the brain and the thyroid. So when the brain is sensing it doesn't have enough, TSH is dropping, then the thyroid will begin the process of breaking all that, you know, precursors of thyroid down and releasing it into the bloodstream. So it releases T4 and T3, thyroglobulin or thyroxine and triiodothyronine. Most of it is in the form of T4. So the reason I call it T4 is because there's four iodine molecules on that on the tyrosine. Or there are three if it's T3. T3 is the most active, but there's not very much of it there. And its half-life is very short in the bloodstream. So it gets released, and it goes to all tissues of your body. Every single tissue of your body needs thyroid. Most of the thyroid that is produced and released into the bloodstream is really not active. T4, when people take Synthroid or thyroxine, that's T4. And it might be from, you know, an animal. It might be synthetically produced. But that T4 that's either being released from the thyroid or you're taking it as a supplement has got to be converted into T3. Most of that occurs within an individual's cells. So your muscles, your brain, your heart, in particular your heart, require that conversion from T4 into T3, and that happens inside the cell. Now, when we measure serum levels of thyroid hormones, and you get a result back and it says your T4 or your T3 or your TSH or whatever it is you're looking at related to thyroid is such and such a value, that doesn't necessarily tell you what's going on at the cellular level, because that T4 that's made by the thyroid has got to get into a muscle cell, it's got to get into your myocyte and cardiovascular system, it's got to get into your brain, and it has to be converted into T3. Now, the conversion of T4 to T3 requires one of three enzymes, and all three of them require selenium in their active site. The catalytic site, that is the site that receives the T4, and this is going on in every cell, the trillions of cells in your body. So T4 enters, it then sees what's called a deiodinase enzyme, thyroid deiodinase, which is a selenium-dependent enzyme, and it converts it into T3. There, the T3 then binds to the thyroid receptor. It goes into the nucleus of the cell, and it activates specific gene sites related to thyroid function. In the heart, it's making a whole lot of different proteins that have a lot to do with the way your heart is working. The myosin and actin, these are fibers that are important for the function. And so a lot of times people who have thyroid deficiencies have cardiovascular problems. They may have arrhythmias. So, but you've got to realize that too much or too little are not good for you. Particularly those individuals that are hypothyroid, subclinical hypothyroidism, even with TSH just slightly above, you know, the cutoffs of what the endocrine society say are acceptable. Now they've taken TSH and gone from 10 to 5 and now to about 3. And they know that really the healthy levels are somewhere probably less than 2. That's your brain telling you that, hey, you know, you're not making enough thyroid hormone. So the thyroid gets into all of the tissues of the body, and it has an important function on how you create energy. The mitochondria of each cell, each and every cell, you need 20,000 mitochondria in every cell. And you can imagine if you have a trillion cells in your body, that's a lot of little furnaces that are there to take the food that's broken down in your gut, that's put into your bloodstream, and break it down and release energy. You don't have enough thyroid, you know what happens. You feel cold. Those people who are thyroid deficient are cold all the time. They're freezing. So they may measure their thyroid in their bloodstream, and they maybe get a note back from the doctor, and the doctor says, you're fine, yet you're freezing. And you know that, you know, when you've taken thyroid that you feel better. So that really is a subclinical hypothyroidism. So there's the issue with thyroid. And again, it's Heart Health Month, so thyroid is really critically important for the function of the heart. And those people who have low thyroid can have poor heart function, and again, they can get arrhythmias. So the risk of death from cardiovascular disease is much higher in people who have subclinical hypothyroidism. In other words, their T4 and T3 are okay, but their TSH is a little bit elevated. So everybody can go Google things these days. So look up, cardiovascular disease and subclinical hypothyroidism. There's some papers published recently about that. But the key that I think is real important for the whole issue about thyroid is tracing it all the way back. Because I'm a scientist, you know, I run a lab too, but I measure thyroid and I'm not satisfied with that because I don't think that's the full answer. So I go back to, okay, what is it that, what's thyroid made of? It's made of iodine. So I want to develop an assay for iodine. What are the other things that are needed in addition to iodine? Well, certainly selenium is important. So developing assays to measure selenium. What interferes with both iodine and selenium from the literature that I've read? Certainly arsenic is huge. I'm really surprised that, you know, even in the United States, we're measuring levels of arsenic in people that are much higher than I would have expected. I don't know what they're eating or what water source they have, but, you know, I'd say 10% of people are way too high in arsenic. Arsenic interferes with selenium. You know what I said, Selenium is in the active side of that protein in your heart muscle, in your muscles in your leg and your brain and everywhere else that convert T4 into T3. That happens in every single cell. Well, that selenium is being locked up, not only by arsenic, but also by mercury. So you can imagine, all right, you've got amalgams, you've got all this mercury leaking out of your mouth into your body. And it, the very first thing it's going to find, it has an enormously strong affinity for selenium. So it's going to remove selenium and prevent it from getting into the body. Arsenic does the same thing. So they both kind of form a complex with selenium on both sides and just lock it up so it can't get in. So that's why we wanted to be able to look at, in urine, we wanted to be able to look at iodine and selenium and arsenic and mercury. And we're looking at other heavy metals that tie these things up. But those are the two, arsenic and mercury, that really lock into selenium and keep it from being incorporated into the deiodinase enzymes. The other thing about selenium...
Wait, Dr. Zava, we need to take a break because this is so fascinating, and I want to come back because you have made such profound points, and I want to make sure everyone really is hearing what you're saying. But before we do that, we need to take a quick station break, and then we'll be right back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. We're having this really interesting conversation with Dr. David Zava. Don't go away. There's lots more to learn. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're having a really interesting conversation with Dr. David Zava. Now, he has co-authored a best-selling book called What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Breast Cancer, How Hormone Balance Can Help Save Your Life. He is also the founder of ZRT Laboratory that has really developed and commercialized non-invasive tests using saliva, dried blood, and urine. And he is... As a dedicated scientist right there at the leading edge, helping us to understand what we need to do to assess and support our hormonal balance. So, Dr. Zava, you made some very profound statements when we were talking about the thyroid. So I want to highlight some of them because I think they're so important. So first of all, when people go in and get measured for their thyroid, they're looking at TSH. Maybe they'll look at T3, maybe look at T4. Rarely do they look at TPO, which is looking at the enzymes indicating a autoimmune condition, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which I believe 80% of women anyway seem to have the Hashimoto's form of it. Is that an accurate statistic in your...
I'd say about 8 to 10% of people that we look at have high levels of antibodies to Hashimoto's. That on our side, that might be a little bit elevated because, you know, we're testing people who have thyroid problems. So it's in the neighborhood of 10% of the population, which is pretty darn high.
Pretty darn high in the population. So TSH is looking at how the message that the thyroid is getting from the hypothalamus. But the thing is that when you're put on a thyroid med, which is Synthroid or one of the generics, it's a T4. Now, T4, as you were saying, is really not the key thyroid hormone that is going into the cells and activating the reactions there that generating the metabolism. You want it to convert to T3, right? Am I right
that's,
so far?
That's correct.
Okay.
I mean, it's the hormone that's entering the cell, but it's not the hormone that binds to the thyroid receptor and activates it at the gene level. It's T3. So there's what's in between, and what's in between are the deiodinases. And the deiodinases, there's really three different types. There's D1, D2, D3. Let's just talk about D2.
Let me just make this point, because this is where I see this all the time in practice. So people are on a thyroid hormone, Synthroid or some of the generics, but do not get improvement. their thyroid is not responding because of the reasons that you went on to elaborate, which I think is so important, because you need those right enzymes. And it isn't necessarily about iodine either. It's about looking at selenium, which is often overlooked. And it's such a critical component because we have such depletion of selenium in our soils. So without adequate selenium, you may not be switching on the enzymes that make that conversion to
That's correct. So let's say, okay, deiodinase 2 is the one that's in the cell, of every cell of your body, that once it sees the T4 coming in, it converts it into T3. Lots of selenium-dependent enzyme. The problem for some people is that selenium is so locked up with heavy metals like mercury, like arsenic, that it can't get into that enzyme. And if it is, it could get locked up with those metals. So all of those reactions, for that enzyme to cleave an iodine off of the T4 to make it T3, because that's what's happening, it's got to be active. And there are things like heavy metals that can keep it from being active. It just locks it up. The binding affinity is enormous, extremely tight. So it just locks it up. It might be there, but so you're cold. You know, you're not going to, you don't internally make T3. Within your cells, you're not going to create energy, and you're going to be cold all the time. So some people taking T4, they say it just doesn't work. They can take T3 and it works better, or the combination of the two. And part of the problem of putting T3 directly into your bloodstream is that T3 has a half-life in the bloodstream of minutes. It's not very long, so it goes up, down. But the brain sees the T3, particularly people using things like Cytomel, which is T3 alone, or high-dose T3, what we see when we do tests is those individuals that are taking T3 alone, their TSH is totally in the dumper. So their brains have been totally suppressed. So by suppressing the brain synthesis of TSH, you're no longer going to drive the thyroid to make its own T4. And what we see, when I started developing an assay for total T4, I noticed that in all these people that had really low T4, they were on a T3 medication. So because T4 is important for, it's got to get in a cell, it's got to convert into T3. That's the way the body naturally does it. Now, you can get T3 into the heart, you can get T3 into the cells of the body. But the problem that I see is if you've got too much T3, it suppresses the brain producing TSH, which suppresses the thyroid making its own T4. Now you've got more of a problem. You've got more imbalance. So that creates even a worse scenario in the end. And I see it all the time. You know, we've looked at millions of people, and I kind of discovered that by just looking at the database, because we keep information about what people are using, how they use it, et cetera. And so when I went to the database and started looking, I looked at all the really low T4 people, and they were using T3 by itself. So because T4 is important for what's moving into the cell and being converted into T3, it's not a good idea to suppress TSH and thyroid synthesis of hormone. Now people, they have their thyroid removed, they take they'll take a thyroxine, a T4, or maybe a combination of T4 and T3 if the T4 doesn't work as well. And that's the best they can do. But still, it's all about, what's going on at the individual cell level. We don't measure that. You sort of measure it by how well you're doing. And that's your symptoms that you're experiencing. If you're still, you know, your body temperature is still low, then you're not, you know, it's not firing properly. So we can look at those things. So I think it's important to look at serum levels to know, okay, how much do you have to start with? Where is your problem lie? You know, is it because you, you know, your thyroid is low because you're, you don't have enough iodine to start with? So we look at that. Or selenium is important also for the synthesis of thyroid hormone and the thyroid gland. We didn't talk about glutathione peroxidase. And thyrodoxin reductase are two critically important antioxidant enzymes in the body. And the glutathione peroxidase and thyrodoxin reductase, they help the thyroid make thyroid hormone with such that the process of making thyroid hormone is a very hot process. There's a lot of free radicals generated. And so these two enzymes are sort of surrounding it and keeping it from getting too hot. It's like containment. It's like an asbestos, you know, or in an oven. It keeps it, it keeps those free radicals from damaging the rest of the cells. Well, guess what is in the active site of both of those enzymes? Selenium. So, without selenium, you have less antioxidants. And we're going back to heart health again. You know, if you want good antioxidants in your body, then you need to have glutathione peroxidase and glutathione. So that's really important, not only for thyroid hormone synthesis, but just overall, you know, capturing all of the of the reactive oxygen species that are forming every time you eat something. It, you know, you overeat, you produce a lot of free radicals, you produce a lot of inflammation in your body. You get a viral infection, you get a lot of inflammation in your body. You get bacterial infection, you get a lot of inflammation. You overexercise, your muscles get sore. Yeah, a lot of inflammation. So you have to be able to deal with that, constantly deal with that inflammation, and the less well you deal with it, the faster you age.
Right.
So I kind of got away from thyroid, but
it comes back to selenium. So let's talk about selenium. So the two minerals we think of the most. Well, number one, we think of iodine as a necessary ingredient for thyroid function. You're also really talking a lot about selenium, which is not as appreciated as iodine. What do we need to know about those? Should we just be taking iodine? Should we be taking selenium supplements? Is that a good way to go? Is that dangerous unless you're tested? What are your thoughts and what's your experience?
I'm not trying to sell a test, but I can tell you that I've seen a lot of people in the testing we've done since we've developed the dried urine test that have alarmingly low selenium levels, and it may be, you know, where they're living or just the type of diet that they have. And I've seen people amazingly low in iodine. It seems like it seems to be pretty closely associated with breast cancer, and they're, you know, I could talk about that all day long. Iodine also by itself is a good antioxidant. And again, going back to heart health, iodine and having adequate levels is that it is it's one of the as far as our evolution going back 4 billion years, it's one of the earliest antioxidants. We would not have evolved as an air-breathing organisms if it hadn't been for iodine, because iodine is an antioxidant. So iodine important, selenium important, locked into the enzymes that are antioxidant enzymes, so very important.
So selenium, do you have a recommendation? I think it's somewhere like 200 micrograms of selenium a day is in most supplements.
Yeah, most of the supplement companies are, you know, you'll see on the bottles, they're delivering 100 to 200 micrograms of selenium. And like anything else, you don't want to get too much and you don't want to have too little.
And that's for testing, actually, in all honesty.
Is really probably 400 micro, you know, up to 400 seems to be okay. Some people with cancer take up to 800, but, and they've done studies, and so that's probably the top end. I don't know if you remember all those polo horses that died from selenium supplement. They get way too much.
No.
That was their supplement.
Yeah.
That's all they had, and it killed them.
Right.
All 50 years. So.
Okay, I have another question. You talked about how arsenic and mercury, which arsenic's in the news lately. They're finding a lot of arsenic in the water, which gets into foodstuffs like rice. I mean, there's a lot of exposure to arsenic. People probably didn't realize it. And then mercury, which is a ubiquitous heavy metal that everyone knows about. And those heavy metals kind of bind selenium. So does that mean we have to be taking more selenium, or so that selenium is absolutely essential for us to be taking, so we have access to selenium? Or is there a way to, if we release the heavy metals, if we do some chelating and can remove some of the heavy metals, it releases the selenium? What do you recommend? How do we deal with the heavy metal issue, which we are all exposed to heavy metals?
Yeah, the literature is pretty clear. I mean, fish that have mercury in them, the ocean fish, they're not as toxic as believed, because the mercury is actually locked up with selenium. There's about equimolar amounts of selenium and mercury.
So we want selenium to lock up the mercury.
It does. So it keeps mercury from being reactive, so that it causes lipids to oxidize. It just wreaks havoc because its oxidation states change, and in doing so, it gives up electrons or rips electrons. It creates havoc within the body. Selenium basically says, look, what are you looking for? Here's the electrons. Now shut up and go away. And that's basically what selenium does to mercury. And it does the same thing to arsenic. And you can actually clear arsenic from your body. Some studies have been done that show that selenium will actually help clear. The interesting thing is that iodine also binds to mercury. And I discovered that from some studies I was doing looking at wastewater. Dentists, they deal with a lot of mercury, taking out amalgams and stuff, and they found that the wastewater, they were using providone iodine. It's that yellow stuff that you see get slathered with when you have surgery and stuff. That the providone iodine, they were using it to kill microfilms, because iodine is great for killing bugs. They don't like it at all. Better than chlorine. Mm-hmm. But it can create some problems, and it stains things. So they were using that to destroy microfilms on equipment and stuff in dentist office, and they realized that there was more mercury in the effluent after using iodine, and what they realized is that iodine actually binds to mercury, and it forms the Hg, which is mercury, and then I4, and makes the mercury more soluble. Now, I don't know what that means in terms of, is it going to move around in your body, but it is another way of getting rid of mercury. And I've wondered whether or not the side effects that people have from, example, the loading dose of iodine isn't related to not so much release of bromine, but release of toxic metals like mercury from the body. And we actually measured that and did see that mercury does go up in urine after a loading dose. I don't know where it goes. I don't know whether it goes. It's getting out of your body, but is it going back around to other areas? So selenium and iodine both. Iodine does more in solubilizing the mercury, but it locks it up, and selenium really locks it up. But I'm not. I don't know whether or not the selenium is actually clearing the mercury from the body, but it locks it up in a form that where it's no longer active. So we're converting ourselves into that, that mercury man. we just accumulate. But if we accumulate it and it has no bioactivity at that point, that's okay.
Right.
It's just going to be there inert.
So,
in the body.
I want to talk about your tests. I would like people to understand the value of what you're doing, and that they can access their test, or they can go through practitioners like myself who can order it and then reevaluate what's gone on and look at the test and put a protocol together.
Yeah, well, we started with the blood spot. You know, I started with saliva, and I said, we can't do thyroid. We really want to do thyroid. And, you know, the sex steroid hormones and cortisol. So we did thyroid, and I thought, well, okay, we can't do it in serum. We could do it in serum, but wanted a simpler procedure. So we developed the finger stick assay. So we developed an ability to measure T4 and T3, free T4, free T3, TSH, TPO, thyroglobulin. So those were basically the thyroids we could monitor. But then realizing, oh, well, thyroid is made from iodine. We need to figure out if people are iodine deficient. So developed the urine assay, and we wanted to be able to develop that in a dried format so it's easy to collect. So we developed that, published a few papers on that, and then realized that iodine, you know, it needed, the thyroid also needed selenium, and the deiodinases were selenium dependent, so I wanted to develop the assays for selenium, so we developed that in the same dried urine, and then realized that, oh, well, selenium gets locked up by heavy metals like arsenic and mercury, so we went and developed those assays for those two heavy metals to get that's what we call our complete comprehensive thyroid profile. Mm-hmm. Is really taking a good look at all those things, because you know your thyroids could be okay so, but you've got terrible symptoms in your selenium. If your selenium is low, or your arsenic is high, or your mercury is high, or something, you know, something else is going wrong there. If a physician is measuring your TSH and telling you you're fine and you know you're not, and you suspect it's thyroid, you got to dig deeper into what's wrong. And often you can find what that is. You know, I remember meeting a woman at a meeting that I went to. She was actually there with a physician. And she was sick. She was very sick. And she just was pale. And there's no reason given, you know, her age and so on, why she should be so sick. And so we did tests on her. And she had one of the highest arsenic levels of anybody I've ever seen. You know, where's that coming from? I don't know, but it's there.
Yeah.
It could be, you know, well water. Could be, in the old days, in the Middle Ages, they called arsenic the inheritor's powder. You know, arsenic and lace, all this other.
Right.
I hate to give anybody ideas, but it's, you know, arsenic, you can't smell it.
Yeah.
You can't see it.
Yeah.
You can't taste it. So if you're you know, getting your water from a well, it could have high levels of arsenic. You never know it. And there are problem wells in the United States. In Bangladesh, it's a huge problem.
Well, Dr. Zava, do you know that they feed arsenic as a growth promoter to chickens?
Oh yeah.
So so the chickens have it, and then their waste
right.
can go into the water, you know, and that's what they're finding.
Yeah, there are lots of stupid things.
Well, you know, you may not believe this, Dr. Zava, but we're at the end of our show. It's an hour.
What time flies when you're having fun?
Isn't it? Just get you going on your favorite topic, and mine too. So this has been so enlightening, and I just want people to know they can visit your website, ZRT Lab. Lab, right? grtlab.com, singular, lab.com, if you want to know more about the testing that Dr. Zava's lab offers. And I just want to thank you for the great work you're doing and the great research to help, you know, bring this more specific understanding that we need to help us with our thyroid and our heart. So, Dr. Zava, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, well, thanks for your show and getting this information out there. You're
My
helping
pleasure.
A lot of people.
My pleasure. Thank you. And for all of my wonderful listeners, thank you for joining me today. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.